We're diving deep into biofundamentals.
Our mission here really is to unpack the core observations, the mechanistic principles that make all biological systems tick.
We're talking everything, right? From the tiniest molecular building block,
all the way up to the big evolutionary processes that have shaped life as we know it.
And along the way, we'll peel back the layers on how science works, how we figure stuff out.
So get ready for some surprising facts, some aha moments.
We're about to see how these, like, seemingly simple rules of physics and chemistry end up orchestrating this incredibly complex dance of life, even down to the tiny, noisy interactions inside your own cells. Our journey into understanding life, it really has to start with understanding science itself.
Science is built on things we can share, experiences, repeatable observations.
It's not about someone having a private vision or claiming some absolute truth.
No, it's about building the best working understanding we can based on evidence we can all look at.
It's powerful. Like, think about Isaac Newton and his prism experiments way back in 1665.
Oh, yeah. Classic example. Before him, the common idea was that white light was pure.
And prisms somehow added the colors.
Exactly. But Newton, through these really careful, repeatable experiments, he showed white light is actually made up of all those different colors.
And the genius wasn't just what he found, but how he showed it. Passing light through one prism, then focusing it back together with another.
Or showing a single color, would it split again? He was building a model you could test, seeking the best explanation that fits the facts, not some forever truth.
Which brings us to that common mix-up, scientific laws versus theories.
A law like Newton's law of gravity, it describes what happens. It lets you predict things really accurately.
But it doesn't always explain why. Newton himself thought gravity needed a sort of supernatural kickstart.
Whereas a theory, that's the natural mechanistic explanation for why.
Like Einstein's theory of general relativity. It doesn't just describe gravity, it explains why it works the way it does.
And crucially, it explained things Newton's law couldn't quite, Mercury's weird orbit. So theories aren't set in stone, they evolve or get replaced when better observations come along.
Okay, stepping back then. This whole rigorous scientific approach, this is why biology can't just make stuff up. It has to fit with chemistry and physics.
It's totally interconnected. You can't have biological principles that fly in the face of established physics. It just doesn't work.
A perfect example must be dating the Earth, dating fossils.
We use really precise methods like radioactive decay, certain unstable elements like specific types of uranium.
They change into elements, like lead, over vast timescales.
Exactly. At a fixed rate, it's like a tiny clock built into the rocks themselves. By measuring the ratio of the original stuff to the decay product, we can figure out when that clock started.
And that gives us the Earth's age?
Yeah.
Around what, 4.5 billion years old?
Roughly 4.54 billion, yeah. Rock solid evidence. And it means any idea of, say, supernatural biology just doesn't fit with the basic physics and chemistry we observe.
Remember Lord Kelvin? He tried to estimate the Earth's age based on cooling.
Right. William Thompson. He thought it was maybe 20 to 100 million years old. Way off.
Because he didn't know about the heat from radioactive decay inside the Earth, keeping things warm.
Exactly. He was missing a key piece of physics.
So why does this dive into the scientific method matter for you listening?
Well, it basically gives you a toolkit. You become your own inner skeptic, your own detective.
You can look at claims, even scientific sounding ones, and ask, okay, is this based on repeatable evidence? Is there a testable explanation?
It's about seeking that evidence, not just taking things at face value, whether it's a news story or some health fad.
Okay. So with that scientific toolkit, let's tackle the big one. What is life?
From a molecular view, living things are these really unique non-equilibrium systems, physicochemical systems.
Non-equilibrium, like a hurricane. That's not an equilibrium.
Kind of, but different. A hurricane forms, does its thing, dissipates, it doesn't leave descendants. Living organisms are a family of these systems.
And they stay in that highly organized non-equilibrium state how?
By constantly pulling in free energy from the outside world, food, sunlight, whatever.
So for a living thing, reaching equilibrium.
That's death. Game over. That's the fundamental difference.
What's really mind-blowing is that all life we know, past and present, seems to come from a single common ancestor, LUCA.
LUCA, the last universal common ancestor. We see this shared heritage everywhere in basic structures, molecular processes.
And the killer evidence is the genetic code, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Every known organism, from bacteria to blue whales to us, uses DNA to store information. And crucially, they read that information using the same genetic code.
So my DNA instructions would actually make sense to a bacterium.
Pretty much. It's wild. This universality is profound evidence for a single origin of all life on Earth.
Which totally dismantles that old idea of spontaneous generation.
Right. For centuries, people thought, you know, flies could just appear from rotting meat or mice from old rags. Francisco Redi started questioning that in the 17th century with his meat and maggot experiment.
Cover jars, open jars.
Exactly. But it was Louis Pasteur in 1862 who really nailed it. His swan neck flask experiments.
Ah, yes, the elegant curve preventing microbes from getting in.
Precisely. Showed that sterile broth stayed sterile unless microbes from the air could reach it. Life comes from life. Omni vivum ex vivo.
But we should distinguish that from Wöhler synthesizing urea back in 1828.
Good point. Pasteur disproved spontaneous organisms. Wöhler synthesizing urea, an organic molecule, from inorganic stuff. That was huge.
It showed there wasn't some magic vital force needed for life's chemistry.
Exactly. It implied the chemistry of life followed the same rules as any other chemistry. You could, in principle, make life's molecules in a lab.
So this chemical basis also helps put things like the Permia hypothesis in perspective. The idea life came from space.
It does. Panspermia suggests maybe life started elsewhere and hitched a ride here on meteorites or something.
It's a cool idea.
It is. But, you know, it doesn't actually answer how life started in the first place. It just moves the location.
Plus, the distances involved, the speed limits of the universe. Interstellar seeding seems pretty unlikely for Earth.
Extremely unlikely. It's more of a thought experiment than a leading scientific hypothesis for Earth's life.
So the big takeaway here. Science shows life is fundamentally chemical and physical. No magic needed.
And all life on Earth is related, stemming from that one ancient ancestor. Deeply connected.
Okay, so life has a chemical basis, a shared ancestry. How did we figure out the actual blueprint, the hereditary stuff?
Early scientists could see these things called chromosomes inside cells, especially eukaryotic cells.
Walter Sutton, around 1902, first suggested Mendel's factors were on those chromosomes.
That was a key insight. But the real game changer, the experiment that pointed towards the chemical nature of the gene, was Fred Griffith's work in the 1920s.
With a pneumonia bacteria, Streptococcus pneumonia?
That's the one. He had these two strains, a deadly smooth one and a harmless rough one.
Right. And he found if he heat killed the deadly ones.
And mixed their remains with the live harmless ones.
The harmless ones somehow became deadly. They were transformed.
It was stunning. It meant some stable chemical substance from the dead bacteria was carrying the genetic information for virulence, not something alive. That paved the way for identifying DNA.
And then came Watson and Crick, figuring out that iconic double helix structure using X-ray data from
Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, crucially. Their data was essential.
Right, and the structure itself is so elegant. Two strands twisting around each other, running in opposite directions. Anti-parallel.
And the genius is in the pairing. Adenine A always pairs with thymine, T-guanine G always with cytosine C.
Held together by hydrogen bonds, two for AT, three for GC.
Yep. And the flat bases stack neatly on the inside, away from water, while the sugar phosphate backbone faces out. It perfectly explained earlier observations, like Chargaff's rules about base ratios, and immediately suggested how DNA could be copied.
So that structure unlocks the whole process, the central dogma. DNA to RNA to protein starts with transcription.
Transcription, that's copying the DNA information into a related molecule, RNA.
Mostly messenger RNA, mRNA, carrying the code for proteins.
Mostly mRNA, yes, but also important non-coding RNAs, like transfer RNAs, tRNAs, and ribosomal RNAs, rRNAs, which are part of the machinery.
And then that mRNA message gets read in translation.
Right. By ribosomes, these complex molecular machines, part protein, part RNA, they clamp onto the mRNA.
And the tRNAs act like adapters, bringing the right amino acid for each three-letter code word, each codon, on the mRNA.
Exactly like adapters. They read the codon, deliver the corresponding amino acid, and the ribosome links them together into a chain, a polypeptide.
And the fact that this code, these three-letter codons, meaning specific amino acids, is almost universal.
That's just incredibly powerful evidence, again, for LUCA, that single common ancestor. It's the same language across nearly all life.
As these polypeptide chains are being made, they're already starting to fold up, right? They don't just flop out as straight strings.
No, they start folding immediately as they emerge from the ribosome's exit tunnel. It's a directional process, N-terminus to C-terminus, and it happens in the crowded environment of the cell cytoplasm.
And that final 3D shape is everything for function.
Absolutely critical. The sequence of amino acids dictates the folding, driven by their chemistry, hydrophobic bits hiding inside, charged bits interacting. Get the fold wrong, the protein doesn't work.
And cells even have helpers for this, chaperones.
They do. Chaperone proteins. They can help newly made proteins fold correctly or rescue proteins that have misfolded or gotten stuck. They act like quality control and can even buffer the effects of some mutations that might otherwise cause misfolding.
But sometimes misfolding still happens. Or it's caused by a mutation, and that can lead to disease.
Definitely. Protein misfolding diseases are a major issue. Think about prion diseases like Kuru or mad cow disease.
Kuru, the one linked to cannibalism in New Guinea.
That's the one. Caused by an abnormal misfolded form of a normal brain protein that then induces other normal proteins to misfold. A chain reaction.
Wow. And all this delicate machinery relies on DNA staying intact. But you mentioned DNA itself is actually kind of unstable.
Surprisingly unstable, yes, thermodynamically. Those phosphodiester bonds holding the backbone together, half of them would break in maybe 500 years or so at just 13 degrees Celsius.
And bases can just fall off or get chemically modified.
Yep. Cytosine can lose an amino group pretty easily. It's estimated that in each of your cells, something like 10,000 bases are lost every day.
10,000 a day. How does anything survive?
Massive repair systems. Humans have over 130 genes whose sole job is to find and fix damaged DNA. It highlights just how critical DNA integrity is.
And this instability, plus the lack of repair after death, is why we can't get dinosaur DNA, right? Jurassic Park is out.
Afraid so. After 65 million years, any DNA would be long, long gone, completely degraded. Cloning a T-Rex is pure science fiction.
So the takeaway here is just, wow, the complexity inside our cells, the constant maintenance, the battle against decay, just to keep the blueprint readable, it's incredible.
It really is. Constant molecular vigilance.
Given that complexity and the need for repair, it makes sense that changes happen.
Yeah.
Which brings us to mutations and evolution, the engine of biological change.
Exactly. Mutations are the ultimate source of all new genetic variation. They're the raw material.
And they're fundamentally random changes in DNA. Errors in copying, damage that doesn't get fixed.
Totally random with respect to need. Environmental factors like radiation or certain chemicals can increase the rate of mutation, but they don't direct the mutations towards being useful.
An organism can't just will itself to have a useful mutation because it needs it.
Absolutely not. It's crucial to get that. They just happen by chance.
The Luria and Delbruck experiment from 1943 showed this so elegantly, didn't it? With bacteria and viruses.
The fluctuation test. Brilliant experiment. They grew up multiple independent cultures of bacteria and then exposed them to a virus, a phage, that kills them.
And they looked at how many bacteria survived, how many were resistant.
Right. If resistance was induced by the virus, you'd expect roughly similar numbers of resistant bacteria in each culture. But if resistance mutations occurred randomly before exposure,
then some cultures, just by chance, would have had an early mutation event, leading to lots of resistant descendants, while others had none or late ones.
And that's exactly what they saw. Huge fluctuations in the number of resistant colonies between cultures. Proof that the resistance mutations happened randomly before the challenge, immunity was luck, not learning, for those bacteria.
So mutations can be tiny, like single base changes.
Which might do nothing, synonymous. Change in amino acid, missense, or stop protein production early. Nonsense.
Or bigger changes, insertions, deletions, even duplicating whole chunks of DNA.
All of those happen, and we distinguish between somatic mutations, those in regular body cells during your lifetime.
Like the ones leading to cancer, where cells basically stop cooperating.
Exactly. They become social cheaters. Those aren't passed on, but germline mutations, those in sperm or egg cells.
Those are the ones that can be inherited by offspring and fuel evolution.
Precisely. And this variation, generated by random mutation, is what Darwin and Wallace built their theory on.
They put together these key observations. One, variation exists and is heritable. We see it all around us.
Two, organisms produce way more offspring than can possibly survive and reproduce. Superfecundity.
Malthus pointed this out, right? Even slow reproducers like elephants would cover the earth if every offspring survived.
Exponential growth is powerful. And three, resources, food, space, mates are limited. There's competition.
So putting those together, variation, overproduction, limited resources.
Logically implies differential reproductive success. Some individuals, because of their traits, will leave more offspring than others in a particular environment.
And if those traits are heritable?
The underlying genes responsible will increase in frequency in the next generation. That's natural selection. Simple, but incredibly powerful.
The modern synthesis then merged Darwin's idea with genetics, with our understanding of DNA and mutations.
Right. It gave the mechanism for inheritance and variation that Darwin didn't have. And it emphasizes that evolution isn't designing things with a goal. It's more like tinkering.
Working with what's already there, constrained by history, like the vertebrate eye having a blind spot because of how it evolved.
Exactly. An engineer probably wouldn't design it that way from scratch. But evolution works with good enough solutions based on existing structures.
And this tinkering leads to new species over time, adaptations.
Absolutely. Allopatric speciation is the classic model. A population gets split by a barrier, like a mountain range or river.
And the two isolated groups evolve differently because they face different pressures or just random drift.
Eventually, they might become so different they can't interbreed anymore. New species. We see stages of this in ring species.
And adaptations are everywhere, like human skin color.
A fantastic example of an adaptive compromise. You need some UV exposure to make vitamin D.
But too much increases skin cancer risk.
So skin pigmentation levels evolved as a balance, varying geographically based on UV levels. It's adaptation in action.
Evolution even explains tricky things like altruism, behaviors that seem costly to the individual.
It does, often through kinship. W.D. Hamilton came up with a key idea, often summarized as Hamilton's rule, RBC.
R is relatedness, B is benefit to the recipient, C is cost to the actor.
So a gene promoting altruistic behavior can spread if the benefit to relatives, weighted by how related they are, outweighs the cost to the individual carrying the gene.
Like worker bees, who are sterile but share many genes with the queen, sacrificing themselves for the hive.
Exactly. Or even things like alarm calls in squirrels, risky for the caller, but potentially saves relatives nearby.
And systems evolve to police against cheating, too, right? Like cells undergoing programmed death if something goes wrong.
Apoptosis, yeah. In some unicellular communities, cells that die can release nutrients that benefit their neighbors, often relatives. Cancer cells are essentially cells that have broken these social contracts, cheating the system.
Thinking bigger picture, how did multicellularity even get started? It seems like a huge leap.
It was, and it happened multiple times independently, which is fascinating. Different lineages found different paths to becoming multicellular.
Predation seems to be one driver.
There's compelling experimental evidence for that. One study took a single-celled green alga, chlorella, and grew it with a predator that eats single cells. Over time, the algae evolved to form simple multicellular clumps or colonies, making them too big for the predator to eat. Selection favored multicellularity as a defense.
Wow. And some organisms are facultatively multicellular, like slime molds.
Right, like Dictyostelium. They live as single amoebas, but when food runs out, they aggregate, form a slug-like structure that can crawl.
Find a better spot and then differentiate into a stalk, which dies, and spores, which survive and disperse. Incredible cooperation. Now, for microbes, things get even wilder with horizontal gene transfer, HGT.
HGT is fundamental to microbial evolution. It's like they have a shared genomic library they can borrow from. It allows incredibly rapid adaptation.
So not just inheriting genes from parents, but getting them sideways from neighbors.
Exactly. Three main ways. Conjugation, which is like bacterial sex, direct transfer of DNA, often plasmids, through a connection.
Transformation, where they just slurp up naked DNA from the environment.
Yep. And transduction, where viruses accidentally package bacterial DNA and inject it into another bacterium.
And the impact is huge, especially for things like antibiotic resistance spreading.
Massive. A resistance gene can appear in one species and rapidly spread to others via HGT. Bacteria can acquire whole new metabolic pathways this way. It really blurs the lines of microbial species.
We even have experiments showing evolution happening over decades. Lenski's E. coli study is amazing.
The long-term evolution experiment. Over 30 years, 70,000 plus generations in flasks. Just incredible dedication.
And they saw E. coli evolve the ability to eat citrate in the presence of oxygen, something the species wasn't thought capable of doing.
Exactly. It took multiple steps, an initial mutation that sort of primed the pump, then a duplication of a gene involved in citrate transport, allowing it to be expressed under aerobic conditions. A beautiful demonstration of new functions evolving through random mutation and selection.
And that megablate experiment visualized it so clearly.
Yeah, the giant petri dish with increasing antibiotic concentrations. You literally watch waves of resistant mutants evolve and conquer higher concentrations. Stunning demonstration.
So the big connection for the listener. Evolution isn't ancient history. It's happening right now, all around us, shaping diseases, shaping us.
Constantly. It's an observable, ongoing process.
Okay, so evolution is happening. But how do scientists actually decode the stories written in genomes? What are the tools?
We have amazing tools now. Huge genomic databases are critical. Things like Genomicus let you compare gene sequences across loads of different species,
helping find orthologs, the same gene in different species due to common ancestry.
And paralogs, genes within one species that arose from duplication. It helps reconstruct evolutionary history.
And comparing the order of genes on chromosomes.
Yeah, it's like comparing paragraphs in different versions of a book. If the gene order is conserved between species, it tells you about their shared ancestry.
Like looking at the gene for lactose tolerance in mammals shows a conserved neighborhood.
But then you look at the human GULO1 gene for making vitamin C and find it's broken. It's a pseudogene.
Which explains why we need vitamin C in our diet. Unlike most mammals, it's evidence of gene loss during evolution.
Precisely. And databases track variation within the human population, invaluable for understanding disease risks or traits.
Like the sickle cell allele, HBB gene, being common in areas with malaria.
Classic example. The allele causes sickle cell disease if you have two copies, but one copy provides resistance to malaria. So where malaria is common, selection maintains the allele despite its downside, a clear evolutionary trade-off visible in population genetics.
And we can look beyond just the DNA sequence to see which genes are active.
Absolutely. Techniques like RT-PCR let us measure the amount of specific RNA molecules. More RNA generally means more gene activity.
And in situ hybridization.
Yeah.
That lets you see where a gene is active.
Exactly. You use labeled probes that stick to the RNA inside cells or tissues. You can literally see under a microscope which cells in an embryo, for example, are expressing a particular gene, like the SNE2 slug gene, lighting up where cells are migrating. It gives spatial information.
Thinking about inheritance, we have to mention Mendel. His pea plant experiments laid the groundwork.
Gregor Mendel, yeah. He figured out the basic rules of inheritance, dominant, recessive factors, genes, way back in the 1860s.
But his work was ignored for decades.
Sadly, yes. Its significance wasn't appreciated until around 1900. But his concept of discrete, stable, hereditary factors was revolutionary.
We also understand linkage now. Genes close together on chromosome tend to travel together during inheritance.
Right. The closer they are, the less likely they are to be separated by recombination. We measure that genetic distance in centimorgans.
And twin studies help tease apart genes versus environment.
Powerful approach. Comparing identical twins, who share 100% of their genes, with fraternal twins, who share about 50%, like regular siblings, helps estimate how much genetics contributes to a trait.
Like blood type being almost purely genetic.
While something like myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disease, has maybe 35% concordance in identical twins, showing a big environmental or random component.
And Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium gives us a baseline.
It's a null hypothesis, basically. It describes what allele and genotype frequencies should be in a population if evolution isn't happening. No selection, no mutation, random mating, etc.
So when we see frequencies deviating from Hardy-Weinberg,
it's a sign that one of those evolutionary forces is acting. It's a tool for detecting selection or other evolutionary processes in real populations.
It's also crucial to remember cells aren't perfect little machines, right? There's randomness, noise.
Definitely. Especially when key molecules like transcription factors or even the genes themselves are present in low numbers. Random fluctuations, molecular noise, can mean two genetically identical cells in the same environment behave slightly differently.
So gene expression isn't always perfectly on or off.
No, there can be significant cell-to-cell variability. And sometimes this noise is even harnessed for biological functions, like helping a population hedge its bets in uncertain environments.
And out of all of this, complex behaviors emerge, things not explicitly coded for.
That's the idea of emergent properties. Things like consciousness or the intricate process of embryonic development arise from the interactions of many simpler components following relatively simple rules, plus that element of noise. It's not all strictly determined.
A lot of it relies on cells talking to each other, intercellular signaling.
Constantly. Cells signal to themselves, to neighbors, over long distances via hormones or by direct contact. This coordination is essential for building tissues, organs, whole organisms.
And finally, we learn so much from model organisms.
We owe a huge debt to fruit flies, nematode worms, yeast, mice, zebrafish, frogs like Xenopus.
Why those specifically?
They're generally easy and cheap to keep in the lab, reproduce quickly, have lots of offspring, and crucially, they are amenable to genetic manipulation. We can tweak their genes and see what happens.
And because of that shared ancestry, The basic mechanisms we uncover in them often apply to us, too.
Very often, yes. They let us dissect fundamental biological processes in ways we simply couldn't do directly in humans.
So the big picture here is that modern biology is incredibly tool-driven and data-rich. It's about interpreting evidence, seeing patterns.
Not just memorizing lists of facts. Understanding the process, understanding the evidence, that's key.
Well, we've covered a huge amount of ground, from the very basis of scientific thinking.
Through the molecular nuts and bolts of DNA, RNA, proteins.
The grand sweep of evolution, driven by mutation and selection.
And finally, how we use modern tools to decode genomes and understand how life works, noise, and all.
We've seen life as this incredibly intricate dance of chemistry, governed by physics, but constantly innovating, constantly changing.
And all of it, remarkably, tracing back to that single common ancestor billions of years ago, a shared thread connecting every living thing.
So, thinking about those constant molecular battles inside your cells, the evolution happening all around us, that deep shared history, what new questions does this deep dive spark in you about your own biology and this amazing ongoing story of life?